This episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, it's been a place to grow, connect, and serve. Of course, during this time, no in-person gatherings are allowed, but that doesn't mean that church is canceled. You can find their live stream on Sundays at 9 a.m. on their website, canbyfoursquare.com, or on their Facebook page. Services and other encouragement is available on their Facebook page anytime. Just search for Canby Foursquare Church.
This episode is also brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768. Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey friends, and welcome to the Canby Now podcast. I'm James Walton. Let's read the news. A former Canby resident who now lives in Clackamas is sharing their experience participating in the Black Lives Matter protests that have shaken Portland over the past week, saying the vast majority of demonstrators were peaceful and just want their voices to be heard. The resident attended the protests on Saturday night at Chapman Square, across the street from the Multnomah County Justice Center, which had been damaged and even set ablaze during escalating demonstrations the previous night, later termed a riot by some police officers. But that's not what this resident saw. Oh, I would estimate that there were less than 200 people spread throughout the park and across the street from the Justice Center, he said. There were chanting, and folks were engaging in motorists driving by and honking in support. Numbers increased, but I believe there were no more than 300 people once the police started to get involved. The demonstrators moved to 3rd and Main and laid themselves on the ground, face down, arms behind their backs, evoking the posture of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died after a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes during an attempted arrest. Within what seemed like 10 minutes, according to witnesses, Portland police told protesters the demonstration was unlawful and threatened to use force if they did not move west, back into the park. The protesters remained in the intersection. At this point, a line of police in masks and armor were moving west on Main, still requesting the demonstration to head west, the witness described. A concussion grenade was sent into the crowd, causing protesters to move quickly back into the park. As the group started to slowly reform on the west side of the park and move back towards the Justice Center, more concussion grenades were sent back towards the protesters, along with tear gas and colored smoke bombs. Portland Police Chief Jamie Resch later said officers had been targeted with fireworks and aerial mortars from some of the demonstrators, others reportedly threw rocks and debris. The group split and headed toward Pioneer Square before regrouping and moving east to the riverfront. Protesters doused their eyes and face masks with water and milk to counteract the sting of tear gas. After several hours, they decided to leave when police said they would start making arrests. But despite the obvious tension, the residents said they did not feel they were in danger. Yeah, the sense of community within the protest group made me feel safe, they said. Folks were spreading supplies and medical attention whenever it was needed. They said they believe the demonstrations are necessary to bring about meaningful racial and criminal justice reform. Property damage is nowhere near the value of human life, they said. Public condemnations are not enough when we need systematic change. As someone who has voted every chance I've gotten since turning of age, I believe we're past the point of any justifiable reform through voting. The Canby Now podcast would like to hear more stories from those involved in or affected by the recent demonstrations and unrest. including business owners who have been impacted and those who are trying to keep the peace. If you'd like to get in touch, please email us at info@canbenowpod.com. A local family prominent in the Newfoundland dog breeding community say they have been targeted with hateful messages after a social media post about their son, Bradley Davis, becoming a police officer that also used the hashtags Blue Lives Matter and All Lives Matter. The Canby family owns the kennel Not a Bear Newfoundlands, which breeds and shows Newfoundland dogs around the world. Not a Bear also promotes the quote gentle giant dog breed on their social media platforms, which enjoy a large following, particularly on Instagram, where they have more than 23,000 fans. The channels rarely, if ever, share anything but Newfie-related pictures and information, posts about cute puppies and funny dogs that would unlikely to draw blowback even during the most divisive of times. But the family says they were inundated with harassment and even death threats following a June 1st Instagram post that announced that their son had joined the Reedsport Police Force. The post was tagged hashtag Blue Lives Matter and hashtag All Lives Matter, along with the hashtag Protect and Serve, hashtag Police Officer, hashtag My Son, and hashtag Cop Mom. Bradley Davis's sister, Bethany, said the family was forced to close discussion on the post after receiving comments such as, "All cops should die," and "I hope your son gets taken out." "Just want to let you know that I'm unfollowing you due to your hashtag Blue Lives Matter and hashtag All Lives Matter," said one private message that was shared with the Canby Now podcast. "You can be proud for your son, but this is distasteful and insensitive and shows you don't care about Black Americans and minorities in general. Dogs learn racism from their owners, so I hope you're not teaching this to your dogs." The son of Not a Bear owners, Becky and John Davis, Bradley Davis, grew up in Canby and has always dreamed of becoming a police officer. He has volunteered at numerous local outreaches since he was a teenager, Bethany said, including Safety Town in Canby, and as a counselor at Canby Grove and other camps. He is a graduate of the nationally recognized law enforcement program at Chemeketa Community College, where he was class president and a member of the school's honor guard. "He is truly a good person, never been into any sort of trouble, and only wants to make the world a better, safer place," Bethany said in a Facebook message. "And people that don't know him, have never met him, are wishing him harm? Even death? A man who only wants to defend them with his life? Oh, it really worries us all. It's scary." Other messages that were shared with the Canby Now podcast were more polite and made efforts to explain why the hashtag phrases were offensive. Most of those also expressed congratulations on Bradley's achievements. "That's great that your son became a cop," one said. "Really, it is. Your parenting will be put to the test in its most truest form. Your hashtagging, All Lives Matter, although true, all lives are not being put in danger. Not all people are profiled because of the color of their skin. Not all people have had the life is going to be hard because of your skin color conversation. My black life matters. So please, if you're going to say that all lives matter, say Black Lives Matter." Bethany Davis said even these messages were not appreciated. "It's really no one's business or job to do this on my own page," she said. "I never asked for any of this. I simply posted a proud moment for our family. How is it anyone's business to enlighten me on my own page? And all lives are being put into danger, as evidenced by these messages wishing death upon my brother and even my family, let alone police and other first responders across the state who haven't done anything wrong." Canby Police Chief Brett Smith has joined law enforcement officials across the nation in condemning the four former Minneapolis police officers whose actions led to the death of George Floyd and who all now face criminal charges for their roles in the incident. Chief Smith said the city and its police department view their relationship with the community as a partnership and vow to serve all people with, quote, equal dedication, respect, fairness, and compassion. Cambie police officers recognize the badge and uniform are symbols of public faith, and we dedicate ourselves to maintaining that trust, he said. We join you in being outraged by the tactics of the former Minnesota police officers, which are in direct conflict with our core beliefs and our mission to protect life. We understand the best solutions come from working together with our community members and recognize the responsibility we carry to protect and serve. He said the Cambie Police Department has worked hard over the past decade to improve his agency's relationship with the entire community, to build and maintain trust with minority segments, and to, quote, eliminate police cultures that would prevent our officers from holding each other accountable. Our department members are dismayed and disturbed when such acts take place that diminish the reputation and undermine the heroic work of our officers that they perform in the service of our community, he said. As we serve our community as a police agency, it is our intent to consistently take the steps necessary to hire persons of integrity, to train and supervise, and to hold everyone accountable for their actions, ensuring what happened in Minneapolis does not happen here. Asked about the protests, Smith expressed strong support for the people's right to peacefully assemble and demonstrate, and said that they have raised legitimate concerns regarding policing policies and practices, while not going so far as to condone acts of violence, vandalism, and looting. He quoted from the late civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. more than once, including one from a 1968 speech that had been cited frequently in the past week. A riot is the language of the unheard. Many Black and minority communities are tired of hearing empty promises of change, the same rhetoric or the language of political correctness, he said. The protests are an outward demonstration of the frustrations felt by many. Chief Smith opposed illegal acts of violence and vandalism, which have been seen from what appears to be a small minority of those participating in the protests, not simply because they are against the law, but also because he does not believe they will help bring about the change that's needed. In essence, riots are not the mechanism to demand justice, he said, extrapolating on another quote from Dr. King. It is important to recognize the frustration people are feeling and experiencing, but to justify a serious assault of a woman while she tries to protect her property from criminals looting her business is an example of promoting further anger and community unrest that will divide and distract us. For more from Chief Smith on this complicated subject, stay tuned to this episode of the Cambie Now podcast. Larger gatherings, longer hours for restaurants and bars, and the reopening of pools, recreational sports, and other activities will be allowed for Oregon counties approved to enter Phase 2 of Governor Kate Brown's reopening plan. The long-awaited guidance for the second phase came in a press conference Wednesday morning, just 2 days before 31 of the state's 36 counties may begin applying for it. Counties that enter Phase 2 may hold gatherings of up to 50 people indoors and allow 100 people outdoors, while indoor and outdoor venues, including theaters and churches, may allow gatherings of up to 250 as long as the standard 6 feet of physical distancing and other measures can be strictly maintained. Restaurants and bars will also be allowed to stay open until midnight, while pools, recreational facilities, and activities such as bowling, batting cages, and mini golf may reopen under new guidance. Offices can begin reopening and employees can return to workplaces with physical distancing and other measures in place, the governor said, though remote work is still strongly recommended wherever possible. The governor also announced that zoos, gardens, and museums can reopen in a limited fashion across the state, regardless of what phase the county is in, and said professional and collegiate sports teams can return to training in their facilities with physical distancing and health and safety measures in place. To move on to Phase 2, counties must remain in Phase 1 for at least 21 days and meet a host of other criteria that demonstrate they are succeeding in controlling the spread of the virus. These criteria, which Governor Brown detailed in a letter to counties, include demonstrating that their contact tracers are able to follow up on at least 95% of new cases within 24 hours and successfully trace the source of the infection in at least 70% of the new cases. Counties must also show less than a 5% increase in new cases in the county over the past week and no significant increase in the percentage of cases that test positive out of the total number tested. Now more than 2 weeks after more Oregon counties began reopening under the governor's Phase 1 guidelines, the state's COVID-19 situation has remained stable, according to the Oregon Health Authority. 2 weeks ago, Oregon had the fifth lowest infection rate in the nation. As of Wednesday, it had the fourth lowest rate. I want to say thank you to each and every Oregonian who has made sacrifices to protect the health and safety of our communities, said Governor Brown. Your leadership, you choosing to be both kind and smart, is why we have been able to start the reopening process. Clackamas County was approved to enter Phase 1 reopening on May 23rd and would first be eligible to apply for Phase 2 on June 13th. Aurora Mills Architectural Salvage, known for purveying antique, vintage, reclaimed, and other found treasures, is building something new. The company is constructing a new 8,125-square-foot building on one corner of the property, about 5,000 square feet of which will be for retail display and sales, with the remainder being employee-only warehouse space. Aurora Mills owner Mike Burns said the new space will complement, but certainly not replace, the iconic and historic mill building, which the company will continue to use as its primary sales floor. Rather, the new building will display overflow inventory and especially large items that don't fit in your typical retail space. A 20-foot-tall canvas poster advertising a circus act, just for example. Yep, we have one of those, Burns said with a laugh. It was for a giant, and it will be for other large items. Back bars, theater lighting, airplane wings? Floorboards, things like that. I like to joke that we could fit a double-decker English bus in there. The new structure replaces a World War II Army surplus Quonset hut that had occupied the space since 1948 until it was deconstructed earlier this year. A buyer in the Seattle, Washington area intends to rebuild the hut there to display vintage vehicles from the World War II era and other memorabilia. The mill broke ground on the new building in early March and is proceeding with the project despite the uncertainty around the coronavirus-related economic crisis. Now, some people think we're crazy to move forward with it, but we've been planning this since 2008, Burns said. I wasn't going to let another recession stop us. They plan to build through the summer and hope to be open by October 1st. It will be just the second new commercial structure building in the city of Aurora in the past 50 years, Burns said, the first being Filbert's Farmhouse Kitchen, just up the road. For photos, find this story on our website at canbenowpod.com or join more of our 2,000 followers on Instagram at canbenow.
Canby, Direct Link is here for you. In these troubling times, the last thing anyone should have to worry about is how to stay connected to their loved ones, work, education, and news. The expert staff at Direct Link are all based right here in Canby and are committed to keeping those critical internet, video, and voice connections on and strong for their members. They have signed the Keep Americans Connected pledge from the FCC, which means they have promised to keep students online to continue their studies, local businesses connected to their customers and employees, and all their members virtually in touch with what matters most to them, no matter how far away they may be. So if you have DirectLink as a provider, go ahead and reach out to your loved ones on a traditional telephone, watch a child's home recital over an internet video chat, download your favorite local podcast, do we even have to ask what it is, or enjoy a favorite movie at home, because DirectLink will keep our friends, neighbors, and local businesses connected, no matter what. We're all in this together.
Hey, quick break in for me here one more time to remind you that the most wonderful people in the world are, of course, our CanBeNow Plus members. These are folks who support the work of live local journalism in the local Canby area through Patreon. And this week, we want to give our undying appreciation to Susan Stewart. We rely on contributions from people like Susan and others to continue to do this work that we love. And if you would like to be, like Susan, one of the coolest people in the world, you can find out more about how to become a supporter of ours on Patreon by visiting canbenowpod.com/plus. Susan, as always, thank you for being a supporter of the Can Be Now podcast.
Joining us on the Canby Conversation today to discuss some of the unrest and demonstrations that have been seen across the country in recent days is Canby Police Chief Brett Smith. Chief Smith sent us a thoughtful and detailed statement today sharing his thoughts on these recent happenings, which you can read in their entirety on our website. Chief, we just wanted to revisit some of those comments here this afternoon. I want to start with the killing of George Floyd, which happened at the hands of four now former Minneapolis police officers. Chief, you described your reaction, and it seemed to be very, very much the same as I think anyone who saw it, just shocked and outraged at what you saw. Is that true?
That is true, yes. The loss of life in that manner, and the loss of life in any particular situation is something to be really concerned about. But in this particular case, the video is pretty dramatic, and you know it's there's a lot yet to be reviewed, and it's now being reviewed at a criminal level, and I'm trusting that the justice system will work. But I think what we see on television is pretty shocking, and I think it's disappointing just because of the negative impact it leaves in the law enforcement profession as a whole, and so from that perspective, it's really disappointing. And again, just to know that someone lost their life in that way is one that we shouldn't tolerate as far as the conduct of police officers.
Yeah, yeah. And you talked a lot about, it was real interesting in your statement, you talked a lot about this idea and even going back to Sir Robert Peel and his take back in the 19th century, but this sort of social contract kind of view of police force, and that at least you see it and many others in law enforcement see it as very much, you know, a sort of partnership with the community and based on a sense of mutual trust and respect. And in this case, obviously, where you see folks that are, you know, took an oath to uphold the law, committing an act of, you know, a horrible act of murder, that was what really struck you, obviously, outside of even just the tragic loss of life in any sense.
Well, I think, yes. And I think my response, it was more specifically the question you'd ask about who's responsible for the safety of uniformed officers who may be facing these kind of demonstrations and who are risking themselves. And at this time, during great tension and divisiveness. And so I think a little bit as I was trying to explore your question and answer it was really, you know, when it comes to safety, you know, initially I had answered that ultimately, as all of our officers have a responsibility to one another from a safety perspective, but it gets much bigger than that. And I think my point was is that while we have great partnerships and relationships with the police, and part of that community policing philosophy has to do with reduction of crime and the prevention of crime and livability, quality of life issues, it goes farther than that. It's working and building on relationships in such a way that during good times, but then in the bad times, that we have each other's back, that we're working together for the same common goal and purposes, so that we have a community that's safe. We have a community that has a quality of life that they can expect. And I think when you talk about safety during these types of events, when there is risk for personal injury for everybody who's involved, we would hope that the relationships during those good times build and remain intact during the bad times, and we're able to work together from a safety perspective so that in this particular case, people can peacefully assemble and be able to voice their grievances and concerns in protests.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go there, because we also did ask you about your thoughts on the protest. We've seen, obviously, in some places over a week at this point. In Portland, I think we had the fifth or sixth night of straight demonstrations. In Portland, I think that we've seen, outside of maybe the first couple nights, really a de-escalation, a much more largely peaceful kind of protest, and avoided what seems in other places, unfortunately, to be really kinds of escalating scenes, which are hard to watch as well.
But you know, we did ask you your thoughts on the protest, and I just wanted to give you a chance to revisit those in terms of what you think about the rights of people to peacefully assemble and demonstrate. You certainly, didn't push that people shouldn't voice their concerns and their anger and frustrations.
No, I mean, I think I would just go back to what I had answered, in that I support every person's right to, peacefully assemble and to protest and demonstrate. And again, that's our constitutional right. And I think it's an opportunity, when we hear people come together like that, we have an opportunity to create change. And I think that can be a good thing. And I think the key piece in there is our constitutional right to peacefully assemble. So as people gather to do that, and they do that in mass, in Portland or all over the country in cities, I think that's good, and that's what we should be doing in all types of circumstances. I think the participating in violent riots is one that I would not support, and because it suggests some people who are there to promote their own agendas, that they're not really there to unite or have a genuine effort to address or solve problems that a majority of people are there to do. And so I think that loss of opportunity to communicate the true message and attempt to accomplish things is lost in those types of circumstances and violent protests. And so have very much of a concern about that and the people's motives and interests that way.
Well, refocusing here a little bit, maybe closer to home and here in Canby, you spoke at great length and really appreciated your insights as far as the types of steps and sort of the processes and strategies and just the way you sort of build a police department and build that trust as well with the greater community that we talked about a little bit earlier. In terms of the things that you and the other leadership of the Canby Police Department had done and the steps that you've taken to try and prevent, anything like what happened in Minneapolis of happening here, I wanted to start by asking you about your thoughts on integrity. That seems to be where you really started as far as kind of the key ingredient, I think, was a phrase you used in terms of having good police work. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, I think integrity is something that is a value and a characteristic that we absolutely have to have, and it's something that we're looking for that people have already. When we're looking for a police officer to fill our position here, Canby, we certainly are looking for people who have talent or ability or capability of learning, and they have good judgment and things of that nature. That's going to be accepted across the board. But one of the things that, we can't train or necessarily get when we're looking at someone who's 21 years and older is what their integrity and what their heart is all about. And so we're looking for people that have integrity, that have a heart and a genuine concern and an interest to serve and to be passionate about that. And we're looking for those types of qualities in people who can fill the position, because we can train on the other things, mm-hmm. but those qualities are the ones that people bring with them that help motivate them to get the job done. And those are things that not everybody has, in the sense that not everybody's designed to fill this position. Yeah. And so looking for those qualities in this position in police work, which is a very difficult job, is an absolute necessary thing. And if we don't have the integrity piece, the heart and the compassion to serve in a way, then it's going to be very difficult to connect with our community in ways that we're going to be successful. And so we can train on the other stuff all we want, and we can be successful there. But what we want is people who bring with them that heart and that integrity with them, and then combine that into their trained profession.
Yeah. I believe the best and simplest definition I've seen of integrity is, doing the right thing when nobody's looking.
certainly. That's a phrase that's been around. I think it's doing the right thing for the right reasons with the right attitude at the right time. In a genuine interest, out of concern for the interests of others first.
Yeah.
So I think that's, you know, that's a tough bill sometimes to find.
Right.
But that's what we're looking for here, and that's what I mean by that. And that's when I think makes a difference when we try to interact with our public, and we're making decisions that are hard, and more often than not, we'll be more successful than we will at failing. So I think that was my intent when I communicated that earlier in your questions.
Yeah. With that being the case, that it really is something that comes out when nobody's looking. Obviously, that's very difficult to find, you know, when in interviews or whatnot. What are some of the ways that you try and identify that from prospective candidates, whether you're looking to maybe hire a fresh recruit or hire from someone who's maybe making a lateral change? What are some of the things you look at to try and identify integrity in a possible candidate?
Well, I think the first thing is that we're not trying to rush into any kind of a hiring. We're really trying to look at the individual, their background, their history. We're taking the time to talk to people and look at their work experience and see what their successes are. And so we're making an effort, and again, taking the time so that we are going to be more successful in making the right choice the first time. And we do involve our community with our interviews. We've included them on our interview process at different times, so we get different perspectives that allow us to also confirm some of our decisions or choices that we think would be good. And making sure that our community and others outside our city who bring perspectives in look like we're picking individuals who would be the right fit and the right choice, who also bring that integrity and that passion to the job that will help us be successful. So a lot of it is involving, you know, the help of others and the perspective of others, but then again, not rushing in our decision, taking the time to look at our candidates in all of their different interactions in their life prior to their hire here.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your statement, Chief, that obviously, you know, this is about George Floyd, a lot of these protests and demonstrations, but it's not just about George Floyd. The protesters and the Black Lives Matter movement are really demonstrating against what they see and what is becoming increasingly obvious in some places is really systemic issues with the police force and with the other parts of our society, where there's built in and even to privileged white people like myself, sometimes even invisible things that marginalize or affect people of affect minorities. Outside of just the discussion of integrity that we talked about and really making that central to even hiring decisions and the culture of Canby Police, what are some of the other ways systematically and culturally and maybe programmatically that you and the leaders, the city leaders and police leaders have tried to really structure Canby Police in such a way that its culture is very able to fit into that goal of treating all people with dignity and respect?
Wow, that was a long question.
I do that sometimes, don't I?
I think, again, your hiring process really is the beginning of all that. But then at the same time, I think we try to lead by example from the top. Mm. We try to represent those values in our leadership, and then try as best we can to communicate that by modeling and either by modeling or communicating or through training that message. And so training is a part of that, obviously. We also try to, like this particular incident, have good discussions. We try to take advantage of these times to discuss those incidents that have happened and learning from them and having those kinds of decisions. Internally hear that those are important, those decisions, to talk about it, I guess. And an example would be is just recently, and well, as of today, the other three officers that were involved in this death of George Floyd have now been charged with aiding and abetting. Mm-hmm. And I think the issue and part of the discussion, you break these down, is just not doing anything okay. And how do we address issues that we see that are wrong in front of us? How do we stand in the gap and not let our fellow officers go down a road or do something that puts their career, their families, their communities, in a bad light? And I think having the voice to stand up and having the courage to stand up. So we have those kinds of examples out there that we can talk about and discuss in our department. And those are things that help shape things like this, and discussing them help shape our culture and move our culture in a direction that's forward, that's trying to do the right thing for the right reasons, for the right attitude, as we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. and trying to have a sense of compassion and understanding, and trying maybe to see if we can, if it's possible, from the perspective of people on the other side, mm-hmm. Who might be experiencing those types of tragedies in their life. So I think those types of things are things that we continue to do. I think, you know, we try to have accountability in the sense of, you know, supervision, addressing issues when they come up, trying to prevent things. If we see areas where improvement can be made before we have things happen. And those are important pieces all along. And there's, you know, it's never really any one particular thing. It's a little bit of everything all the time, over time, mm-hmm. that help grow our department and help us to learn and to try to do better. So I think that helps quite a bit. But I think taking advantage of the opportunities that are out there to discuss them, to learn from mistakes, to learn from wrongdoings, and realize what the consequences of those are can be informative, but also very powerful in how we continue to do our work in the future.
Yeah.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate, and we got in a carriage ride with the horse, and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months. Sometimes it's a couple years. Sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
One thing that I wanted to ask you about, that there have been other more heartwarming moments or more positive moments where it seems that officers often or police leaders. In one case, there was a county sheriff. Have really seemed to diffuse tensions by doing, you know, either showing some sign that they're listening or understanding. You know, there have been scenes even from Portland where police join the protesters in taking a knee. I wanted to ask you what you think of that, and sort of does that kind of play a role in your perspective of trying to understand where folks are coming from, their legitimate concerns and frustrations? Is that part of what you see as maybe police department's role in being that and in having that relationship with the community?
Well, I think in some of those really success stories that you might be talking about, the sheriff or some of the departments, I think one of the big key, there's a couple key things, I think. But I think you said one of them. One of them is listening.
Yeah.
Are we really listening? And or are we trying to respond and not really hear what's being said?
Yeah.
There's a lot of value and power in listening, allowing people to tell a story without interrupting them or questioning them. And there's lots of time to work through those. But I think initially you have to listen and you have to be able to hear what people have to say. So I think that's a huge part of that. And I think the other one, and I think I'm familiar more specifically with the one with the sheriff. I think it was out of Flint, Michigan.
Yeah.
And, you know, that town has had some incredible hardships.
Yeah.
That town just really folding up economically, and the population, the police have had incredible struggles about trying to hire and maintain officers there due to the town and the financial economic struggles that the town has had. And as a result of that, that community also is bonded and has a relationship with the police department that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. In a lot of different ways. And I think, again, some of that success is based on the relationship you have with the community and being able to talk with them in a way that big people, again, feel heard and feel that you're genuine. And it doesn't start that day. It really starts before all this. And yeah. I think some of those success stories you have is based on the relationship that's positive, that's good, with the place in their communities that they serve. And I think that makes a huge difference there. But I think those are two things that really stand out that will probably be more received from people who are in that position of protesting than a lot of other things out there being done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chief, I appreciate your time so much. I have just one more question for you. Going back a little bit to my earlier comments, but just in terms of safety, you know, I hate to think of our police officer being put in harm's way. And, you know, I hate to see that. And I know that that's been happening. What is your perspective on that? Is it a certain extent? Is it kind of, you know, unfortunately, that's part of the job sometimes? What steps sort of go into that to try and do all that you can to protect officers who are serving this important job on the front lines of a very difficult situation?
Yeah, I mean, officers put themselves on the lines every day. I mean,
yeah.
A lot of unanticipated events that, you know, no matter how well you plan for an event, you just can't expect everything. So there's a sense of hypervigilance in an officer's life every day, starting with traffic stops and not really know who's behind the wheel until you get up there. But I mean, we do try to train and try to remember those things as officers, so that, you know, we're better prepared, I guess, for the thing. I mean, nobody expected, COVID-19 to come down the track, and then we're all looking at ourselves again, looking at a different way that our potential health or safety is put in jeopardy, like everybody else. And we're here 24 hours, 7 days a week, and we didn't go home. And so, you know, there's another perspective. So how do you work with that? And I think it's just looking at each and every potential threat that we have and addressing that. But many of the officers that we have before they got here understood there are risks and to this job. And anybody that's getting in law enforcement today who isn't aware of those types of risks and the potential complaints, if you want to say, or concerns about the judicial system is probably pretty naive and shouldn't be in the business. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people understand that. So as we move forward, we try to be really sensitive to all those risks. We try to plan accordingly, try to prepare. You know, safety is our number one consideration for all officers. So, you know, we want to do things safe. And so we try to look at all of those things as we go out to work. And it really starts, Tyler, really from everyday routine things, being able to have enough people on the street so that when you're doing patrol in the middle of the night, you have enough cover.
Yeah.
And being able to have a response when you end up with somebody who's resisting the police and you're all by yourself. You know,
right.
We don't want to put people in those spots. So, you know, our whole job and how we schedule and how we approach our work, regardless of what the circumstances are, involves how do we look at it to do it in a safe way so that not only is the officer successful in accomplishing the goals and can go home at night, but also the interaction we have with our public is also safe because we have enough support and training to do that. So that's just something we think about on a regular basis. And do we have events like protests that come out and, like I mentioned, COVID that bring a sense of higher anxiety? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But we try to plan for that so that we can do it the safest way possible for officers, but also for our community.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, instances of violence and things sometimes come from just, you know, latent frustration and anger that bubble below the surface and come out in times of stress. And I think that our police officers, as you said, you know, they put themselves in harm's way. They assume a lot of that risk, really oftentimes make themselves a target for some of this violence just by being there in the dangerous times when that stuff comes out. And that is something that I personally am so grateful for and respect so much because, you know, Canby's one of the safest cities in Oregon. We say it all the time, but that enables me, a citizen of Canby, to often go about my day and not have to worry as much about being harmed because we have our officers that are standing in those places. So I thank you and your folks for that. Chief, is there anything that you'd like to say before you go?
No, I thank you for the opportunity to be able to at least let people know kind of about where our department is. But again, you know, I'm very thankful for the opportunities to serve here. I'm very thankful for our community and the support that we have. I really appreciate the partnerships that we have here because I think our officers enjoy working here in the city as well. And we've had one or two officers that have left thinking maybe there with other opportunities and have since come back, realizing that Canby and its community bring with it a lot more benefit to serve here as a police officer. And so very thankful for that. And I'm glad for the opportunities for us here as a department in the city. So I would probably just end with that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Lieutenant Jose Gonzalez being one example of that. He entered the police force at Canby, went up to Portland, and, you know, only, 28 years later, came crawling back. So just like they always do.
Well, I can think of even three others as well that came here, they left, but they came back. And they didn't leave here on bad terms.
Right, right.
They left here just because of they thought from a career decision there may be opportunities elsewhere. But when they got an opportunity to experience those other locations, they came back and realized the richness of this city and the benefits here. And they've been back and they've stayed and
yeah.
They have not left.
Yeah.
And so I think that says a lot about Canby.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of that, to be a part of that as well here. And I'm hoping that we can continue that. And I'm hoping that our relationship with our community is such that we're proving ourselves and earning the respect of our community even in tough times and even controversial times, but we have an opportunity to be available and transparent to our community so that there's trust there. And that's what we're going to continue to work on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Chief, for taking time out to talk to us on a very complicated and a very difficult subject. But I'm sure a lot of the listeners and the community can be appreciate hearing from you on this. So thank you.
You bet. Absolutely. Thank you.
And finally, we conclude this episode of the Can Be Now podcast with Can Be Then, which is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. They're open daily, and you can find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant in downtown Canby, or connected with them through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. Well, as you heard in our previous installment, the telephone has been a part of Canby life since 1904, when the Maxburg Mutual Telephone Company, later known as the Canby Telephone Association, was formed by local farmers to bring the miraculous new technology to the rural communities in which they lived and worked. There were many reasons they wanted to bring the telephone here, mainly the chance to almost immediately connect with folks on the other side of town, the state, the nation, and eventually the world, and all the opportunity for business and personal growth that entails. But the telephone was, perhaps, never more needed in Canby than during an unusual episode on July 4th, 1947. That's when a young lad boarded a Greyhound bus in his tiny hometown of Doris in Northern California, bound for a visit with his uncle in the even smaller vale of Canby, California. It was a journey of 60 miles, which would normally be completed in an hour and a half or so, but this would not be a normal trip. When the bus reached Klamath Falls, the lad sensed something was wrong and inquired if he was on the right bus to take him to Canby. The driver assured that yes, he was. He kept traveling and traveling, and the fourth was sliding by when all the time he thought he should be celebrating the day with his uncle and his relatives, the Canby Herald reported. The anticipated picnic dinner of fried chicken, ice cream, and pop seemed to fade with the day. After about 6 hours, the boy arrived, of course, in our humble city of Canby, Oregon. He had arrived in the right town, all right, but in the wrong state. Arriving in Canby, Oregon in mid-afternoon, the youth looked dubiously at the surroundings, again asking if this was Canby, the Herald wrote. Assured it was, he looked around for his uncle who was to meet him, but no uncle. In fact, nobody. Helpful citizens and local police helped the boy search for his relatives' names in the phone book, but to no avail. They checked the youth's ticket, but that was no help. All it said was Canby, and that's where he was. Then the local Greyhound agent, previously experiencing mix-up with packages intended for Canby, California, having been sent here, hit on the idea that perhaps it was possible for passengers to be missent, the Herald records. That was it! The $2 jaunt had turned into a $15 ride for the youth, and he was in the right town but in the wrong state. Thanks to those turn-of-the-century farmers, telephone calls and telegrams went out to frantic relatives who soon had things sorted out. Greyhound officials ordered that the lad be well cared for, and a bus bound for Canby, California, left town at 11 p.m. that same night. Reflecting on the incident, the newspaper noted, after recovering from the disappointment of missing the celebration with his relatives, the lad declared that he had gotten older and made his own money. He was surely coming back to Canby, Oregon, for the people here were very nice. Telephone lines, along with electric utilities, were knocked out in Canby later that year, when an honest-to-goodness cyclone of disastrous proportions touched down and did serious damage. Those who got the worst of it included the farms of Arthur Harriman, Carl Scharschmidt, and Neil Haynes on the outskirts of town. Forming over the Willamette River in the Riverside District, citizens were amazed and shocked to see a peculiar funnel-shaped black cloud sweep down with a great roar, destroying property and trees in its path, the Herald described in its account of the incident. The Scharschmidt's house on Garden Homes Road lost its front and back porches in the storm, which shifted the entire structure at least 6 inches off its foundation. Bizarrely, there was little damage inside the home, with even the dishes remaining safely inside their places in the cupboard. A good-sized machine shed looked 100 years old after being hit, and the cyclone had made a clean getaway with a smokehouse, the newspaper said. Neighbors across the road had just completed the construction of a trailer house, and it was completely demolished, only 2- and 3-foot-long pieces remaining. Telephone lines survived a different natural disaster that struck the area 3 years later, but they were busy for hours. A mild earthquake hit the town on April 13, 1949, causing little damage but causing nearly every resident to experience a brief bout of vertigo, according to the local paper. Oh, the commonest remark is, "I thought I was having a dizzy spell," the Herald said. Most people got over that idea as soon as they noticed that everything loose around them was swinging or rolling. No reports of damage as of press time that edition, though a display of dishes in the window of Cutsforth Market was, quote, "considerably disarranged." There was a report that a plaster ceiling in the biology room at Canby High School had been cracked by the shakeup, the newspaper notes, but others said the crack had appeared before the quake. Stores, offices, and houses emptied all over town as people went out into the street to see what was going on. Some called the Herald offices to see if it had really been an earthquake. M.J. Lee, Mr. Canby himself, was consulted and said that the only other earthquake he remembers in Canby occurred in 1888. He was then a youth of 16 and sitting in front of the Canby post office. M.J. Lee would later die the following year, at the age of 78. In 1952, the Herald documented an episode in which a telephone receiver had been left off the hook. That must have been a very slow news week. CTA switchboard operator Rena Reynolds tried to alert the homeowners to the issue by making a clicking noise to attract attention, but to no avail. Finally, when she heard voices on the other end of the line, she whistled loudly and shrilly, something she'd learned to do as a youngster. That did the trick. "We thought that clicking was rats in the wall," homeowner Ray Magnus explained to Reynolds. "Mrs. Magnus and I each had a club and we were looking for them. When you whistled, I realized all of a sudden that rats don't whistle, and we picked up the phone." Though a small town, Canby has made its mark on state government and history throughout the years. The story of the Oregon State Treasurer, who also kept the books for the Canby Telephone Association, is next time on Canby Then. And that concludes this episode of the Canby Now podcast. I'm James Walton, wishing you, as always, a wonderful day. Thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by the Wild Hair Saloon in Canby in Oregon City. The coronavirus has changed much about how the Wild Hair does business, but it has not changed the where, the why, or who they do it for. Owners Joan and Darren Monin, both lifelong Canby residents, are as committed to the community they love as they've ever been. Even as the service industry has been deeply impacted by the current public health situation, they continue to rally behind Canby, its people, and especially those most in need. We are so grateful for their continued support in this difficult time. As we've always said, the Wild Hair is a place where Canby goes to eat and have fun. That hasn't really changed. You just have to take your food and, you know, go eat it somewhere else. Until the governor's stay-home orders expire, the Wild Hair's friendly staff will be there to handle your carryout orders Monday through Friday from 11:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. They continue to offer their full menu of delicious food options, and they're doing a weekly meal deal that serves a family of four for only $25. Find the latest on their Facebook page, full menu available online at thewildhairsaloon.net. Give them a holler today at 503-651-4273.
The Canby Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Canby Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Canby Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.